Radio Mysterioso. We can't have dead air now, can we? Although dead air is appropriate for this evening's discussion.
Yeah, it's Radio Mysterioso here on November 5th of 2006. I really should have had this show last week, but I didn't think of it. And I also wanted to play all the Halloween music because there hasn't been a music show here in a while. Remember for a while it was all music for a long time? Now it's all been interviews. And tonight, as promised, if you read my blog at spacebrother.blogspot.com, we're going to have ghost hunter Richard Sennett. I just finished taking a class with him on ghost hunting, Southern California edition, at Ventura Community College, and five-week class. They went on a couple of field trips. I only went on the one today. They had them on the weekends, and if you've been listening to my show, you know I can't do anything on the weekends except this show. So let's try and get a hold of Richard Sennett here. And we'll be back right after some music here, which I should have put on. Ghost in the Invisible Bikini. No, that's not going to work. It's not long enough.
What happened? You got Casper the Friendly Ghost?
Yeah, but that's not very long. Right. I've got Mostly Ghostly. That's one of my favorites.
How about some poetry? He bangs his fists against the posts and still insists he sees.
Oh, you know
ghost.
What I'll... You know... Huh?
You never heard that one?
Against the posts and what?
He bangs his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghost.
I've heard that one, yes.
Is that Yeats?
I'm not sure if it's Yeats or Keats or...
I'm sorry, Yeats, Keats, Cates, Yeats.
Cates.
Yeast.
There it is. This is the one I played, and I got some email about it, so I'll play it again. It's a musical version of The Raven. Can you believe it? I love it. Radio Mysterioso.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door. Only this and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember, it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember brought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow, vainly I had sought to borrow from my book surcease of sorrow for the lost Lenore. For the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. Into that darkness peering, long as I there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming, dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word Lenore. This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word Lenore. Merely this and nothing more. Open here, I
hung
the shutter.
Okay, we got Richard here on the phone. Yes, I'll play the rest of that at some point. Richard, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. Let me do a little introduction here. Tonight we're going to talk to Richard Sennett. He's been stalking ghosts for over 20 years. Is that right?
That's correct.
He's the author of a number of books on the subject, such as The Ghost Stalker's Guide to Haunted California, Ghosts of the Haunted Coast, The Haunted Southland, and Ghosts of the Ojai, California's Most Haunted Valley. Actually, I recently took a class with Richard in ghost hunting at Ventura Community College, and I don't know why I didn't think beforehand already that he would be a great guest on the show. This morning, actually, we went to the Olivas Adobe, which is allegedly one of the most haunted places in California. We didn't see any ghosts, but Mr. Sennett was a treasure trove of historical information, since that's his training. And we were privileged to get the sort of tour that the normal visitor never gets. Mr. Sennett's a historian by training, so we'll just let him describe how he came to be California's best-known ghost hunter. Welcome to the show, Richard.
I'm glad to be on.
Great. I don't suppose you've ever heard this show before. Usually, as you probably know, we're talking about UFO stuff and conspiracy stuff, and the paranormal just doesn't get as much of a say, so I wanted to change that a little bit or a lot and bring you on. It's a we're really lucky to have you on. What did you do before you were interested in ghosts? What made you decide to be a ghost hunter, if I can use that term?
Oh, that's a good term to use. I don't like to use the term ghostbuster because I don't bust ghosts. I have a hard time putting handcuffs on them, so I don't bust them. No, actually, I was involved in archaeology and history, and I've always been in love with history. I have a great affinity for the American Civil War, for instance. But I was doing some archaeology up at one of the old California missions back in 1978, that summer. And while I was working late at night, I went into the courtyard and saw what appeared to be a monk. And when I approached the figure, because I believed it was one of the brothers who still lived at the mission, the thing just disappeared. It wasn't there anymore. And it left me really wondering, you know, what had I seen? What was this thing? And since that day, I've been investigating ghosts, haunted houses, and psychic phenomena.
Yeah, when people talk about ghosts, there's so many different definitions. You say ghost, and you think of something flapping around and with a sheet on and all that. But what, for the uninitiated, what are ghosts? What are they really? What does that word encompass?
Oh, it encompasses a great deal. In fact, if there's anything that's wrong with the study of ghosts, of parapsychology, it has to do with our terms of definitions. Every group, every particular ghost hunter seems to have their own definition of what is a ghost, what is a spirit, what is an apparition. I use them all generically. A ghost is something you see, you hear, and have experienced, but something that isn't really there. That's one of the definitions that I've used.
Okay, you know what, Ed, we're going to have you on for as long as you want, as long as it's under 2 hours. So you can feel free to elaborate. You don't have to do the radio thing where you have to have a sound bite. So
whatever you want to say.
We talked about this in class, and I was really fascinated to hear some of the ideas that I had had from my reading in the literature and paranormal literature, parapsychology, was exactly what you came up with and exactly what you were talking about in class, and then you elaborated on it. Maybe you could do it here.
I was so erudite.
About theories behind what apparitions, ghost hauntings are.
Well, there are so many. See, that's a big rub with this entire field, is it's a little bit like kind of walking on Jell-O. We can speculate. We can put theories forth, but we really don't have a lot of facts to back them up. And I expressed in the class a number of theories, one of which is, I think, responsible for many ghosts, and that are warps, are tears in the fabric of time. And there's several good examples which you could point out that could give credence to that theory.
That's my favorite theory, actually.
One of the most dramatic took place in England in 1909. People in southern England saw zeppelins flying over the various country towns. Now, there were no zeppelins over there. There were zeppelins. They were of Germany. And relations between England and Germany had deteriorated. But there were no airships. In fact, the British government, the newspapers, called them scare ships, not airships. Well, anyway, years later, the Germans would send zeppelins over England to bomb London. The zeppelins were the first strategic bombers. So I think those scare ships seen in 1909 were simply looks into the future when real airships would fly over. That might account for some of the ghosts that we see. They may be images from the past, like seeing soldiers on Civil War battlefields, for instance, or images of the future, where people see something that's, not there yet.
You know what's very interesting is when I read that on your website, that Coming of the Scare Ships article, it is strangely, although not so strangely, reminds anybody that's a UFO fan or ufologist or whatever, of the airship mystery of the late 1800s, 1897, 1898 in the United States, mm-hmm. where people saw these people flying in these things that looked like what they would call airships, but they weren't really airworthy. They were powered by steam engines, and the gas bags were far too small to lift whatever it was.
Well, not really. In fact, I did a study of the 1897 airship flap
uh-huh.
that took place in San Francisco in the western United States, and I read through some of the accounts. Then I went through the known technology of the day. Now, they did have gasoline engines.
Right.
They did have control planes. They had been experimented with in France. And they did have hydrogen lifting power, which had been used successfully for well over 100 years as stationary and free-flowing balloons.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology was there, just no one had as yet put it all together. So it's possible, not probable, but possible that there was an American genius who put all the pieces together and actually constructed such a ship. In fact, one of the accounts is kind of mysterious. In it he states, or one of the witnesses stated, that the man actually communicated with him and said he was planning to fly his invention to Washington, D.C. to give it to the U.S. government. Well, of course, it never reached Washington, D.C., and these newspaper accounts stimulated Jules Verne to write a book called Master of the World based on these particular accounts. So is it possible? Yes. Is it probable? No. Or was it a look into the future? Or was it some mass hallucination? I know the first airship wouldn't really fly until 1900 in Austria under Ferdinand von Zeppelin.
Uh-huh.
So it's an interesting theory, but could an airship have been invented in 1897? The answer is yes.
Oh, well, amazing. See, most people in the UFO field say, well, these things were imaginary, or there was something very strange that people were putting their own ages, what do you call it?
Definition.
Yeah, definition on what they would expect to see. Rather than a disc with aliens in it, they saw some strange inventor from possibly some foreign country. Some of them said they were from Cuba and South America and all that. And that was exotic and weird and out of this world, basically, to them.
Well, the thing that they mostly talk about are seeing propellers.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know much about ufology, but UFOs don't use propellers. And people also told about bright electrical lights coming out of them, which
uh-huh.
could, of course, be a UFO phenomenon. There is just so much out there. And I think stories like this give hints and clues to the fact that there may be rips in the fabric of time. Perhaps, it's just a theory, perhaps what people saw were helicopters and other real airships from the future.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, interpreted them in their own way.
Right.
In fact, UFOs may well be simply public transportation of the 22nd century. And we are seeing them and giving them an exotic background and saying that they're from Venus or the Pleiades or something
right.
like that. And, of course, they just might be from Cincinnati or something like
yeah.
that we're just seeing them through the fabric of time.
Well, I've sidetracked you a little bit. You were describing different theories about what ghosts, hauntings, apparitions, these things might be. One of them was the hole or rip in the fabric of time. What else would there be?
Oh, there's another one that says that emotional traces can be left onto a site. It is, the theory is that people, when they undergo great stress, they shoot out of their body a psychic energy. Now, we are creatures of electricity. That's a fact. And it's believed that this energy, some psychic force we have yet to define, impregnates itself into buildings and environment. And when a person in the right frame of mind with the right psychic gifts walks into that area, it can play back kind of like a videotape. And that accounts for some sightings on, like, Civil War battlefields, places where people undergo great stress, such as hospitals or courtrooms or things of that nature.
Uh-huh.
So it could very well be that these emotional traces that people encounter are the true meaning of some of the more colorful haunting ghosts that are a blind historic record that we have.
I'm looking at my notebook from the class. In the first class, you listed different types of ghosts, which I thought was very interesting. And I'd heard of them all, but I'd never had a kind of a dictionary definition of what types of ghosts there were. And you alluded to some of those in your explanations about theories. But
those theories were all taken from the British Society for Psychical Research. Mm-hmm. Especially from a brilliant man named George Turrell, who wrote a classic book, which I recommend anyone interested in the study of ghosts, apparitions, hauntings, what have you. I recommend you read that book. It's out of print, hard to get, but find it and read it. And it's called simply Apparitions by George Turrell.
How do you spell his last name?
And if you get that book, it'll give you a lot of the same data that I gave in the classroom and the definitions of ghosts. Now, this book, by the way, is not just a collection of ghost stories, though it has a lot of ghost stories in it.
Well, it has to.
It's really kind of an analysis of what people see and classifying ghosts by their behavior patterns rather than anything else.
What? How do you spell his last name?
Turrell, T-Y-R-E-L-L.
Oh, okay, I spelled it wrong.
Yeah, he was the...
What year was that book?
President of the British Society for Psychical Research.
What year was that book written?
1952.
What types of ghosts did he categorize in that book? I have the list here, like crisis apparition and postmortem.
Well, crisis apparition was one. He had some great stories out of World War II. A haunting ghost was another. And, of course, postmortem apparitions, which is another classification that he developed. And, of course, hallucination, which is a classification only because it's something that I think also accounts for ghost sightings. Just as all UFOs aren't mysterious objects, the same is true with ghosts. They're not all ghosts. Many times people accidentally see something or experience something they mistake to be a ghost. Other times, you know, these sorts of things happen where you're not quite sure if they're imagining it or not. So you have to include that as a definition.
I remember you said that a post-mortem apparition has to be dead 12 hours. Why is that?
Well, that was the definition that Turrell put together in his book. And that was because, well, you have the kind of ghost, crisis apparition is at the point of death. And there's a strong linking of the crisis ghost with telepathy. So a person undergoing the stress of death in a faraway land thinks of a loved one. Oh, my wife, I'd like to say goodbye to her. I'm dying here in the middle of Singapore. And back in England, wife sees a ghost of her dying husband. That could be linked to telepathy. But if the husband has been dead for 12 hours, there's, well, we believe no telepathic link could be established, and therefore the cause of this must be supernatural, caused by a post-death existence.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the 12 hours is kind of arbitrary.
Well, that's what he picked, I think. I think it was arbitrary, but I think it's a necessary definition,
yeah,
because we want to kind of find out, make sure that whatever this is, it comes from a source outside of the living individual.
Maybe the 12 hours is a kind of a window that's semi-arbitrary in that the energy created by a living body maybe takes at least or somewhere 12 hours or less for it to just finally power
it
down.
It may have some physiological background. That's the definition for it. But I think it's a very necessary one and could go a long way to define the properties of that particular sort of phantom. The phantom also has another name. It's sometimes called the purposeful ghost. And they seem to always come back for a reason or a purpose. It might be to save someone's life, or it might be to give some instruction or something like that.
Oh, I didn't mean to scare you there with the ghostly voice that came on. This is Walter, who's my co-host often.
I kind of figured it was someone like that.
Ooh.
I've been telling him about the class, so he was excited to come in and listen and also ask some questions.
That's quite all right. Nice to meet you, Walter.
Nice to meet you, Richard. I'm looking forward to this.
Mm-hmm.
Also in my notes that haunt is the German comes from the German word for house.
Yes, it's an old English word, haunt, and which is Germanic, of course. Our English language is a Germanic language, whether we like to know it or not. And the word haunt comes from this word for house or place. So haunted house is kind of well redundant.
Mm-hmm. And that's also a type of ghost or apparition is a haunt, which is something that stays there for a long time, sometimes years, sometimes only a few days, a few months. I found it interesting that you said that haunts seem to die away after a while.
Well, a number of English parapsychologists have come forward with the theory that a ghost actually has a lifespan, and it's about 400 years. And their theory is that over time they will simply get fainter and fainter until they become like a little ball of light, and then they're gone forever. Now, of course, I don't know if I buy that, because there have been ghosts sighted in Italy that are obviously of ancient Romans, which are far older than 400 years.
Yeah.
So people in togas, people wearing the armor of the centurions and such as that.
Uh-huh.
So I tend to think that ghosts may actually skip or travel through time. Again, I think time may be as the key here. The ghost I saw that just abruptly disappeared, I believe it didn't disappear at all. It simply skipped through time. So here I am on Wednesday or Thursday, and then all of a sudden, the ghost jumps into Friday. Now, I can't follow it because I don't have that particular gift, so I'm left behind quite literally in the dark. Now, according to the same theory, in the ghost perspective, I would disappear as it jumped into the next time zone. And I think ghosts jumping through times, maybe skipping up to 50 years, might well last centuries.
So
yeah, that makes sense.
Therefore, in your theory, then, just so it can be said, so people can understand, ghosts aren't always people who have died, obviously, if they're coming from the future, if they're just skipping through time. These are not dead people.
It's very true. We are left with a lot of enigmas. One, people have seen ghosts of people who are still alive. And then here's one that's really weird. People have seen ghosts of apparitions that never were alive. People like out of fiction. People have encountered the ghost of Sherlock Holmes. But, of course, Sherlock Holmes never lived. He's a character from fiction. So what are we looking at here? There's another theory that ghosts might be created by us. That we, concentrating on a particular character like Sherlock Holmes or some other fictional thing such as a unicorn or a satyr or some god from ancient Greece, if we concentrate enough and we meditate, if there's enough people who believe it to be real, we might cause something to be projected out into space or into our own environment and cause people to see it. So if enough people think about, seeing a unicorn or Sherlock Holmes, maybe they will in time encounter that as a ghost.
So Peter Pan was right.
Well, maybe so.
James Barry.
And characters of imagination.
Especially in that area where things are not so clearly defined, and the kind of my idea is kind of a spaceless and timeless realm that we can see once in a while impinges on what we call our reality, but exists, they're not really running on in any kind of time stream. They're just there. They're just there, and time doesn't make any difference. If they were there a million years ago, and they're going to be there a million years from now, and they're there here. They're there now, too. But every once in a while, we get this little window that pops open, and we can see these things, and maybe they can see us, like you said.
And perhaps we are their ghosts.
Exactly.
Well, there's another theory about ghosts, and that is that there are various dimensions. And I had a friend of mine who was a physicist who speculated that there were other dimensions spinning off of ours all the time. Whenever there was a trauma that hit the timeline, it would shoot off a separate dimension.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Anyway, these are spiral-shaped things that spin off. And so existing at our time, there might be other dimensions way off where Hitler won the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some sort of bizarre Nazi world. And then another one, the 9/11 disaster didn't happen. And there's a whole different timeline there. Now, the theory is that these dimensions occasionally interact with our own dimension. And we get faint glimpses into their world, and they get faint glimpses into ours.
Yes, yes.
Now, in those other dimensions, there's duplicates of ourselves as it spins off, you see. So that might account for people who see ghosts of themselves or people who are still alive or see images of the future or past, because in that dimension, time has sped up. And the people living in that particular time are far more technologically advanced than ours today. And conversely, there might be other dimensions where time has slowed down technologically. It's kind of a Star Trek approach to the study, but these interdimensional bleed-throughs might account for some of the misty figures of ghosts that people see.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. As I was kind of saying, everything, every possibility exists all the time,
mm-hmm.
It seems like. And I talked to a parapsychologist, Dean Radin, and he said, well, what another way to look at it is like rails. Like all these possibilities are traveling on rails, and instead of running into the car in front of you, you avoid it, and you jump onto the rail in time and causality where you don't run into that car. And you continue on. But then in the other reality that you jumped off of, you did run into the car, and maybe you died.
He's got the same idea.
Yeah, pretty much the same thing.
So it's a real confusing thing, but it does account for these strange things that people do encounter. So I believe when we get to the bottom of ghosts, we're really going to get to the bottom of the nature of reality itself. And I don't think there's probably one answer, like are the skeptics who do so much to debunk ghost hunting and parapsychology.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there's one definition, like spirits of the dead. Well, some appear to be spirits of the dead. That's only a small amount. There are so many other things out there that might account for these mysterious sightings that people talk about.
Another one of the things on your list, another type of ghost, which everybody knows about because of the movies and all that, are poltergeists.
That is one of the most exciting areas of study. Now, people have been recording poltergeist cases for thousands of years. We have accounts going back to 4,000 years in ancient China. And, in fact, the Brothers Grimm, you know, the fellow who wrote the fairy tales?
Mm-hmm.
They also collected weird and bizarre stories. So they were a little bit like Forkian in their ideas. And a lot of the stories they collected were of poltergeists. So we have a lot of history about them. Now, there's a big debate raging in parapsychology on whether poltergeists are caused by spirits, as the theory implies, or whether they're caused by psychokinetic energy. It's believed that the person who is the focus of the poltergeist might be subconsciously shooting off energy and causing the things to happen. Now, from what I've studied and what I've read, many of the events that happen seem to be symbolic, and many times they're directed towards a particular wish or desire of the poltergeist focus. I remember talking about in class a case in England, again brought out by Terrell, where a young woman was forced to give up her bedroom to an aunt whom she hated, and at one particular instance, the knife levitated, flew across the room right at the aunt, and then at the last minute diverted and buried itself into the wall. The aunt left.
Yes.
All the poltergeist stuff stopped. So it could have been some sort of a psychokinetic ability this person unleashed subconsciously.
One of my favorites, which went on for years and years, that you discussed in class, was the Bell Witch incident.
Yes, and that was well documented by the Saturday Evening Post newspaper and by a number of local newspapers. In fact, one of the people that went so far as to investigate the case was Andrew Jackson, President of the United States. Pretty good account of what occurred, though there are many elements that might be folkloric about it. I'm sure they were twisted with the retelling. They do document what appears to be a destructive and murderous poltergeist.
Let's talk about the case for a while, because I found the book somewhere. It was written by a descendant of the Bell family, I think Charles Bailey Bell. The Bell Witch, A Ghost of Tennessee, I think it's called.
Well, there's about seven books written about it. In fact, one of the first was written by Richard Bell, who was the son and witnessed not all but many of the events that were talked about. It started out very similar to many poltergeists. There was a first bizarre animal scene. A huge, giant black bird, a gigantic wolf-like creature, and in both cases, John Bell shot at the figures without the ability to harm them. It's like the bullets went right through them.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, they would hear like a knocking sound and a scratching sound, and then this like a trance would fall upon Betsy Bell, the young girl, who was about 12, I think, at the time. Maybe she was 14. And a voice would come, not from her mouth or her throat, but from a space about 2 feet above her head. And even people who put their hands over Betsy Bell's mouth to stop the voice would still hear it. And it announced itself to be several things, finally saying it was a witch. There was a local elderly woman who was accused of being a witch. And so evidently it kind of took on that persona and directed all of its hate and venom towards John Bell. And eventually it haunted him to the point where he died.
Yeah, but Betsy seemed like the focus of it all. It always treated the mother very well, because apparently...
Oh, yes.
You know, the focus, Betsy, was very well disposed to her mother, but apparently she had some problem with her father, and some people, maybe even you said this, that maybe she was molested by her father, and then when she wanted to go get married, he was against it. So, of course, he wasn't against it, but the witch was very much against her marrying this one man.
Well, it's theorized by a parapsychologist from the 1920s and 30s, a very eminent man whom has kind of gone out of fashion, Nandor Fodor.
Yes, I know of him.
F-O-D-O-R. Sounds like a hobbit, right?
Yeah.
Well, Nandor Fodor was a psychologist, and then he had some psychic things happen to him, and so he got deeply involved in parapsychology. And he analyzed that case and suggested that she had some sort of love-hate thing going with her father, and speculated it was caused by some form of sexual abuse. Now, he did find there is a link to sex with parapsychology.
Oh, most definitely.
So it has to do with young people going through puberty. It usually happens around the time they become sexually active. There is this kind of vague link to what happens. So it's possible.
Actually, that's something that people, folklorists and people that study the paranormal, have noticed for a long time, that there are Bigfoot sightings, there are monster sightings, there are UFOs, apparitions in lovers' lanes.
Mm-hmm.
quite a bit.
Mothman.
Lots of ghosts appear in Lover's Lane. And many times, the ones I've investigated anyway, they're bizarre things. They're not... See, most ghosts try to duplicate life. So, as a rule, people aren't 10 feet tall, as a rule. and so ghosts usually aren't 10 feet tall. Most people walk around with their heads firmly attached to their heads. Now, they don't walk around carrying their head under their arm like you hear the folklorists talk about. So the ones that we get on Lover's Lane tend to be these bizarre, strange creatures, such as locally there's a small town close to where I live where the ghost is called Chicken Man. It's a man, but he has the head of a chicken. I don't know how scary that would be. I guess maybe
scary.
It's a rooster or something. But anyway, we have another fellow that's a ghost, Lover's Lane ghost, which has a head of a ram. Almost sounds like some kind of Egyptian mythology here. And there are stories of headless ghosts. There are stories of women with no faces. There are stories of bizarre burnt apparitions, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So it tends to be, I think anyway, something to do with projection, projecting out of the imagination, the subconscious, rather than a real figure of some kind. But again, that's so far as I know. It's only a theory. But
right.
You're right. Lover's Lanes are haunted.
The ram-headed one, is that the Bilowak monster?
Bilowak monster, right. So many stories I've gotten of that, and I've heard their ghost stories. Talk about conspiracy theories. Gosh. The story I've heard, which I think is kind of unique, is that it had to do with World War II and Nazi experiments to create a super soldier. And supposedly, Americans captured some of the documents and attempted to duplicate the experiment, a genetic experiment, in Santa Paula, in this old abandoned dairy.
Yeah, the Bilowak Dairy.
Bilowak Dairy. And it went awry. Something happened. And they created super creatures, all right, but they refused to take orders and were just belligerent. And so they had to kill them. But one escaped and now haunts the area. And, of course, even though it's been 60 years since that experiment, this creature is a super soldier, so he doesn't age. Is not succumbed by other problems. So, you know, there is a couple of things that are interesting. One, the guy who owned the dairy was in the OSS. That's a fact. Two, he died mysteriously on a mission.
Right.
That's another fact. So what really happened? I don't know. But I've gotten some interesting accounts. There's a place in Arizona, an Air Force base, and one of the people on the base told me on the Internet that they have seen a similar creature on that base. In fact, he was given an order that if he saw the creature, he was to call it in, but he wasn't to shoot it. Whatever he did, he wasn't to actually harm the creature. So perhaps experiments like that were conducted in a variety of places during World War II.
Yeah, and after.
And after,
if you think about Roswell, that's one of the theories about it. Actually hooks into that, the genetic mutation monster kind of storyline. Have there been any recent reports on the Bilowak monster? Because I tried to find the Bilowak Dairy, and I couldn't find it.
One particular monster account I got from some kids who were up at a school up in Santa Paula late one night. Now, I don't know if they were using controlled substances, but all four of them saw this creature with glowing red eyes, the horns on its head like a ram, this huge fur-covered body, and they added an interesting element. It said that rather than have feet, it had hooves, like a sheep, you know, a cloven hoof, which I guess is also symbolic of the devil.
Yeah.
And they said the thing actually went up to their car and looked at them, and then ran off and just disappeared into the underbrush.
How close is it that the dairy? I tried to find it once, but I had a lot of problems. Is it close to the airport there?
No. In fact, it's
Oh, is it?
It goes
okay.
Way up. It's on Aliso Canyon.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's up there. And, of course, you can't miss it because it's covered with no trespassing signs and lots of big dogs. But, no, it's a spooky place because I've been up there. And I have heard that there are a maze of underground tunnels.
Yes.
And
yes.
I've been wanting to get down there, but I've not gotten permission. And, of course, they won't give you permission. And they hate anyone investigating this monster, this creature, whatever it is, that haunts that area.
Who's they? The people that own the property now?
People that own the property, yes.
What are they doing with the property? They're just letting the old dairy rot?
Yep. They're doing nothing with it, which is also kind of curious because the housing boom and all, hey, that's
yeah.
a beautiful spot. That could be turned into condominiums. But, oh, no, for some reason, they don't touch it. Hmm.
It's the old monster burial ground.
You know, you had
yeah,
a point there.
Like that, I guess. But the monster is just one of several of its type throughout the country.
What did you want to say, Walter?
I was just going to add, and Richard's probably heard of this, the Barton Mansion in Redlands, up as late as 2003, there was stuff on the web about it's one of the most haunted places in
He's
the state
there.
Of California. Yeah. And now I went over to look at it a couple of weeks ago, and it's been turned into office space, this business office space. So, you know, if they'll develop that, it is curious why this dairy is nothing's being done with it. What are they sheltering?
I don't know, but as I say, it's the deep underground tunnels. Who knows? Maybe the experiments continue.
We got to find those tunnels, damn it. Do you know where they are?
I wish I knew, but I've had people. In fact, I had this lady who called me up in the middle of the night. She called me up, and she contacted me later on the Internet. She had some bizarre pictures of what she thought was a monster. She had climbed on top of her car, and in the dark picture, there were two red eyes. Now, whether they were the monster or a cat or who knows what, I'll never know. And she did have pictures of the entrance to the tunnels, and she was going to lead me in to the laboratory, so she said. And then all of a sudden, she dropped off the face of the earth. And I tried to contact her, and I finally talked to her husband, and she said, "We don't want any of that nonsense." And he hung up on me. And I've never heard from her or them again. So
oh, too bad.
What happened? I don't know. Maybe the monster got her, or the men in black, or the little red creatures from another world, or the people in white coats.
I was about to say from her husband's attitude, it sounded like not the men in black, but the men in white got her.
Yeah, it sounded that way to me. But she seemed to make pretty good sense. I mean, you know, when you talk to people, especially in this kind of work, you kind of gauge responses from individuals. You can tell pretty quick if they're nutso or if they really legitimate to say. And she, for all the years I've talked to people, she appeared to have, you know, all of her marbles.
Uh-huh. Huh. Well, you know what? We'll move away from the Billowack monster, which has always been a favorite of mine since I read about it in Mike Marinacci's book and that came out, Mysterious California, that came out in 1988, I think.
Yes, I helped Mike with that book, as a matter of fact.
He's one of the co-writers on Weird California, actually. I finally got to meet him. I really like talking to him.
He's a nice guy. In fact, I led him through the Oliva Sadovi once, years back. Gosh, I hope he's doing well.
He is. Apparently, he's doing well. I think he's working for a bank I think an employment agency or something like that as an executive. I think his parents ran it or something like that. His parents are both historians or at least interested in history, and that's where he said he got his interest.
Well, that's great. I'm glad. In fact, history is kind of a much maligned subject, and I'm glad there are people out there working to keep the historic record alive and keeping it before the public.
So we were talking about the Billowack Dairy and what was the name of the mansion? The Bar?
Barton Mansion.
Barton Mansion.
Business offices.
Where is the Barton Mansion at?
The Barton Mansion is on Barton Road and, I'm doing a brain dump.
What town, though?
It's on the it's like where Redlands meets Loma Linda, and it is up on Barton Road. I'm just not remembering the cross street. It's right on the corner. It's the mansion that was built in, I believe it was built in 1850-something, 1854 or so. and all sorts of terrible things and terrible hauntings and frightening stuff and other kind of amateur, if you want to call them, paranormal investigators put stuff on their website as recently as 2003 that are allegedly photos of the apparitions they saw. Plus, there was satanic activity there. The whole thing, apparently a big, big haunted site. I went over there to take a look at it myself a few weeks ago, and it's been totally refurbished. There are some, probably a handful of various businesses in there. One's a custard production company. One is just, you know, just your typical business thing. I'd be interested to know if any of those employees there or those businesses are encountering any kind of paranormal activity.
I would dare say that's very possible. Now, oddly enough, I haven't investigated that place, but I have investigated the Bard Mansion over in Port Hueneme. Similar kinds of things happening. There's a place up near Simi called Bell Canyon. You ever heard of it?
No.
There's caves there with all kinds of strange phenomena linked to that. And I was able to trace that down to a cult that operated in that canyon back in the 1950s. They were a group called under Krishna Venta, kind of a mixing of Hindu and Christian philosophy, and this guy Krishna Venta ran his cult with an iron fist, and eventually they killed him, and a number of other people killed him as well. There was a big blast, and it blew their headquarters to pieces, but they used those keys for meditation, and I guess they're still, their cult members are still there worshiping and doing what they were doing back in the 50s.
Where is that?
Bell Canyon, it's up there near Simi Valley.
Huh. See, I drive by there all the time coming up to Santa Barbara and Ventura, and I don't even know about these places. Just like you mentioned Reyes Adobe and Ventu Park Road and all these places in California.
And Reyes Adobe, you should have recognized as a giant off-ramp. So
yes.
Reyes Adobe Road.
Well, I didn't know it was haunted.
You get off the off-ramp, and there you are, right? And it is definitely haunted. I had a chance to do an investigation there about 3 weeks ago, and we had even the reporter, who's a pretty skeptical lady, she saw a ghost there. I love it when things like that happen.
What did she
but
do?
People who were skeptical are now not so skeptical because of what they see. And so I definitely believe that that place is going to acquire more and more ghostly stories as it more and more people go through the site.
What did the reporter do? Did she run screaming from the place? Or?
Oh, no, she just saw. Most people don't run screaming from the place. You see, ghost sightings are so dang short.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about seconds, not minutes. And they're so abrupt and so unexpected that usually when you see a ghost, it's so weird. It's so odd. It's like watching some kind of bizarre natural phenomenon. And so you're just sitting there thunderstruck.
Yeah.
You're awestruck by it. You don't get scared till after it's all over with.
Right.
And after that, she was pretty frightened, I think. But she looked over and she saw this light just floating down these stairs.
Yeah.
And something she hadn't expected.
Yeah, it's funny. You think you see movies and people run screaming, of course, but the reality of it, as you describe it, and I've never seen any kind of apparition. I don't think I've smelled one, it was so short. You seem like your first reaction would be fright, but no, it's kind of like a startled awe.
Yeah, that's the best way to describe it. You're making a mistake. A lot of people do this. They say, "I want to see a ghost." A better term would be encounter a ghost, because you can smell them, you can hear them. In fact, hearing ghosts are far more common than seeing ghosts. See them, of course. You can feel their touch. You can detect them with all of the five senses, as well as, I believe, a sixth sense. Because I've heard this over and over again in haunted places. They always talk about feeling as if someone is watching them,
mm-hmm.
especially, or in one case, like they were being stalked by some kind of wild animal. and I just feel unnerved by it. Now, yeah, I go into a place and say I have a haunted house, and you ask, well, what have you seen? Nothing. What have you heard? Nothing. What have you smelled? Nothing. And then finally, it says, I just feel like I'm not alone. There's somebody watching me. And I've heard that too often to just explanation.
Uh-huh. You know what? Another thing you brought up in class, which I never really thought about, you know, you have ideas of it from books and movies and all that are bad or evil ghosts or hauntings. And people think, you know, that they've got a certain idea of what that is. Like there's, you know, evil glowing red eyes and devils with long fingernails and all that. But the way you described it was quite different and kind of startling to me, or at least surprising. You described it as a black that's blacker than the darkest room.
That's what I've been told by witnesses, and it is very frightening. In fact, when I first got into this, I thought it couldn't exist. I mean, ghosts, they have no substance. They're just shadows of other times or places or people. So how could they actually harm people? But over and over again, I've gotten accounts of people who've lived in houses with these things or whatever they are, and they become sick. They become tricked. People, they try to kill people, try to get them to stumble down the stairs and maybe break their neck. They're definitely evil. And I've been to a few places where you just feel the evilness. And if anything could be described as demonic or satanic, that might be the thing.
But you also were quick to emphasize that it's a very small percentage of what people encounter, just like in real life.
That's true. Just as there are a few real people who are evil. Yeah, there's a few Saddam Husseins, there's a few Jeffrey Dahmers out there, but they make up, you know, like 5% or less or 2% of the population. Most of what we think of as evil is simply selfishness. People mm-hmm. not thinking of other people's needs and putting their own needs ahead of others. And that we kind of call evil. I don't think that's a proper definition. But in truth, there are far more positive forces out there than they are negative.
How do people deal with this? These evil ghosts or evil hauntings or things that are trying to frighten them out of their house or kill them or make them sick or whatever?
They usually run. They usually run. And there's not much. I've tried to help people who've had this kind of ghost. And finally, I turned to one lady after my fifth attempt to help her. I said, why don't you just pack your bags and leave?
Yeah.
That's the best advice I could give her. Now, oddly enough, a new family moved into that same house, you know. And mm-hmm. I, of course, approached them to find out, oh, is there anything, like, odd happening in your house? Nothing. They were perfectly happy, no problems, no nothing. So whatever it is, it may have something to do with the makeup of the people who were there, as opposed to the house being haunted by some horrible negative force.
Right. It sounds like another thing you brought up, and which I had written about in the book, was the entity haunting, as it's called, the one from, as you say, from San Pedro, where
mm-hmm.
the woman, I don't know who lives in that house now, but the woman moved out, and apparently it followed her, and is still following her.
That was my point.
Yes. In fact, I believe that these entity cases, which is proper term would be an incubus, has something to do with poltergeists. There's some sort of projection of some sort. That's my theory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it might well be that she's acting as a subconscious medium. Now, I have actually worked on a few of these cases. They're very rare, and it's very hard. I mean, the first thing that you go through is mm-hmm. thinking maybe this person's wacko
mm-hmm.
and needs a psychiatrist rather than a parapsychologist. So I do have them seek medical attention. I mean, I'm not foolish enough to think that I have all the answers. And I did instruct her to see a psychologist and to
mm-hmm.
Take the medications he prescribed and such as that.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually, by the way, the psychologist and I worked together on the case
mm-hmm.
and found it to be quite rewarding, and eventually we were able to help this one woman
yeah.
who had a problem that had plagued her for like 16 years.
Mm-hmm. Rich, that's what I was going to ask you, and Greg got to it, about ghosts that will attach themselves to someone and follow them around. And what are some of the manifestations? Is it just the classic stuff, or is there anything particular or to a ghost that will attach itself to someone?
Well, ghosts that attach themselves to people usually do so for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things you've got to do when you do ghost hunting, is you're a bit like being a detective. You want to find the reasons why they're there. Many of these attached ghosts are, in fact, family members or loved ones who attach themselves to a person. There are certain families that seem to have a ghost that lingers with each generation. Such a thing happens in my own family, where there is a supernatural something or other, we don't know what it is, that seems to attach itself to the particular family. We call the force the Great Leveler. And that means that when people do us dirt, always bad stuff happens to them. And it does. The leveler will level it out. And other people, like in England, they give warnings of death, things of that nature. But a lot of the attached ghosts are more linked to poltergeist activity. As a rule, poltergeists do not hang around long. Average is about 6 weeks to 4 months. And then usually they're gone. The Bell Witch was quite exceptional in that it lasted a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
But most of these cases, they're almost gone before they think about hiring someone to come in and investigate.
Why do you think that is? Because of the problem, whatever it is taken care of in that amount of time?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's like a great mystery is there. What is this thing? What is causing things to move around the house? You know, a lot of times they think it's fraud. That's the first thing people think of. Someone's throwing rocks at their house, or one of the children are causing things to occur. And sometimes, by the way, that's true. I've been to places where people actually are throwing rocks, or where kids really are breaking things to get attention.
Right.
So those are the kinds of things that things happen. They come in, they're very abrupt, they almost form a bell curve in a poltergeist case. They get far more active until they reach a crescendo, then they go down the other side of the bell curve, things get smaller and smaller, and then they're all gone. And once a poltergeist comes and goes, it doesn't come back. So it's really kind of an interesting study, but it's almost, some parapsychologists don't even study poltergeists anymore. They're just too common.
They're common? I didn't know that.
You know, they are very common. But usually most of them don't turn into the cases that you read about. Most of them are knocks, raps, things like that. And then they get come, a few things disappear, a few things appear, then it's all over with. So they're a lot more common than one would think.
Well, yeah, if you think about it, if it's centered on a person, it's just like, you know, you have 800 people playing baseball, and you've got two or three people that are really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And it may, since it's attached to a person, maybe that person just has some kind of latent ability they weren't aware of, and it causes, you know, it causes them to have this, you know, major league performance in whatever's going on in their house.
I think that's very true, and I've seen, I've looked at the focuses. Those are the people the poltergeists are attached to. They all tend to have certain elements in common. One, they're above average in intelligence. Two, they tend to be repressed. That means these are not the demonstrative children who get into a lot of trouble. These are the quiet ones that don't do anything, you know. The ones that don't give any problems at all, they're the focus of the poltergeist. It's almost as if there's some sort of rebellion subconsciously going on, and they somehow cause the events to happen around them.
Well, you know what? What I originally asked was, why do you think this dies off? Because whatever the problem is just they take care of it, or they just get tired of worrying about it, or the parent moves away.
The poltergeist events are almost like solutions to problems.
Oh.
And once the problem is solved, like the case of the lady who moved in on the family in England, and once the lady got frightened to the ghost that moved away, there was no more longer a need for the poltergeist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just like in the Bell Witch case, once the father was dead, there was no need for the witch. She had done her job. This might be some kind of a projected subconscious force sent forth to do a mission of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have, in the Betsy Bell case, her father she loved, because it's the 19th century and you're supposed to love your father, but the man she also hated for his sexual abuse. So she couldn't attack him, but through the witch, she could.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, exact her revenge.
Richard, we're at the top of the hour. Would you like to talk about this for another hour? Because I certainly
sure.
would. Well, let's take a short break so I could turn my my virtual tape over here to start the next one. We'll play a little bit of music, and then we'll be right back with Richard Sennett, our ghost hunter friend and guest this evening.
Sensations falls fastly, ghastly, the way she floats on air and walks through walls. Indeed, she's mostly